Well, good morning, everyone. As Juno said, Happy New Year. It is officially 2015, which is crazy because that means it was just 15 years ago that we were all running around gathering in bulk plastic water bottles and canned foods because the world was ending with Y2K. That's crazy. That was those were fun times. But hey, it's that time of the year. There's New Year resolutions going on. We all want to, we're going to quit smoking. We're going to quit drinking. We're going to get that new gym pass. We're going to go on that special diet. We're going to get that special degree or education. We all have energy and ambitions, and we are ready to go. We're in a good, fun mood. So I kind of figured I'll continue this good and fun mood, and we'll start kind of, we'll try something new this morning. And I'm actually going to have a conversation with a well-known but controversial rapper. That's right, a rapper. It is some type of music, although I know some of you may disagree. Now, you'll be pleased to hear that I'm actually not playing his music or beatboxing myself, but his name is Kanye West. If you don't know Kanye West, here's a picture of him. Good old Kanye right there. If you're unfamiliar with Kanye, the thing you have to know is that he isn't the most humble or modest of individuals. He's actually self-admittedly quite full of himself. So I thought I would share some of his more adoring and timid quotes from recent past interviews. Speaking in the third person, and whenever someone speaks in the third person, you know something strange is coming up. He says this, quote, "I think what Kanye West is going to mean is something similar to what Steve Jobs means." Steve Jobs, by the way, if you don't know who that is, he's dead now, but he was the founder of Apple and changed computers and culture at large. Kanye says, "I am undoubtedly, you know, Steve of the internet, of downtown, of fashion, of culture, period, by a long jump." Elsewhere, he says, quote, "I am so credible and so influential and so relevant that I will change things." And of course, he has to bring God into it. So he says, quote, "I'm like a vessel and God has chosen me to be the voice and the connector." For you sport fans out there like me, he gives you a little analogy. He says, quote, "You know, if Michael Jordan can scream at the refs, well, me as Kanye West, as the Michael Jordan of music, I can go and say what's wrong and what's right." And finally, perhaps the best moment, when someone recently asked him about his album that came out last year, his most recent one, the title of a song is "I Am God." So they asked him, "Hey, Kanye, like, why'd you title the song that way?" Well, he's pretty short and to the point. He says, quote, "I made that song because I am a God. I don't think there's much more explanation." End of quote. Now, in some ways, if you're like me, I actually find these quotes absolutely flat out hilarious. The reason for it is because, well, I don't take him actually to be all that serious. I'm sure he's exaggerating to get a flare and reaction from the media. But the thing is, if you know Kanye West, he's actually being serious at the same time, though. And there's no doubt that he is absolutely creative, talented, skilled, and worth a lot of money. If you know anything about the hip-hop or rap industry, he's probably one of, if not the best, hip-hop and rap artists out right now. I think he's won something like 21 Grammys. Pretty impressive. So there's no doubt that Kanye's creative, talented, valuable, all these other things. But you know what? When it all comes down to it, he just rubs us the wrong way. We find him to be egotistical, narcissistic, and arrogant. And we just don't like people like that, no matter how valuable or cool or good you are. This raises an interesting question, though. Because if we use the same logic that I just went over, we could ask a question that actually countless people throughout the history of Christianity have asked in the church and outside of the church, and it's this. Is it arrogant, egotistical, and narcissistic of God to command people to worship him? Why does God command us to worship him? I mean, if he is so good and so loving and so all-powerful, why does he even need our worship? Is he insecure? Is it out of self-conceit? It's an interesting question, and maybe you've never asked it before, but people have, so just take a step back and think about it. Because really what this question will do is it'll force us to wrestle with the actual inner dynamics of worship. Why do we worship God? More importantly, why does he have us worship him? So next week, we're going to start our vision series. We're going to be in it for 4 weeks, kind of the month of January. We're going to launch and look at what do we want to be as New Life Community Church for 2015. Where are we going? What are we doing? Why are we doing it? And so it almost just kind of seems right to take one Sunday before that and just to pause and to maybe tackle one of, if not the most fundamental tenets of Christianity, and that's that we are to worship God and him alone. Because I think if we get that right, I think everything else will probably fall into place. So we're going to look at one of the most well-known biblical chunks of scripture in our culture today. Christian or unchristian, you probably know it. And it actually is the first text in the Bible to explicitly deal with this notion of God commanding us to worship him. It's the Ten Commandments. So if you have your smartphone or if you want to look on the two TVs behind me, we'll be in Exodus chapter 20. If you don't have a Bible, we have these which are underneath some of the chairs. We would encourage you to use them. I'm still old-fashioned. I love to have a physical Bible in my hand and not look at a screen. So if you're using them, it's on page 52. And I will read the text out loud for us. Exodus 20, verses 1 through 6. And God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or in the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. Now, I know we all have to get past our images of Charlton Heston and the old original infamous Ten Commandments movie. If you've been to the movie theater recently, you know there is a new Exodus movie called Gods and Kings. Christian Bale is our new Moses. I was actually just talking to a couple of people before the service about it. As a side note, hey, there's been a lot of movies in 2014 about the Bible. I can think of three off the top of my head. And let me just say this. Don't ever expect Hollywood to literally follow the Bible. And that's okay. Because I think sometimes we as Christians are known in the cultural sphere as just speaking negative and just criticizing film. And I just want to say Hollywood isn't there to verbally obey and commit to what Scripture says. That's okay. So let's be people who are positive and not necessarily criticize. I know that's been me before. That's a quick side note. That one was for free. But the Ten Commandments, we have all these classic debates on them. Should they be posted in a public square? Should they be in an elementary school? Should they be in a courthouse? And we're so culturally conditioned to think of the Ten Commandments a certain way. It's an ethical code book, moral guidelines, good rules to follow. Everyone would agree that, yeah, thou shalt not murder. That's a great idea. I think any society should probably listen to that. Those things are all true. But I think when we leave it at that, I think we grossly misunderstand the actual dynamics and the original meaning of the Ten Commandments. And so if you look at Exodus, this big book, this story that this text is taken out of, there's a running stream, a running narrative throughout it. And it's freedom, released from oppression. And so Israel, who becomes this nation, this group of people, is in slavery to Egypt and to Pharaoh and to Pharaoh's gods. And so Yahweh the God of Israel, who we worship, goes in there and frees Israel and releases them from oppression. And so, kind of like Kanye West, there's no point, it's actually black and white, clear at this point, that God is the best. The whole point of the 10 plagues was a demonstration that Yahweh is mightier and bigger than any of Egypt's gods. So it's clear, Yahweh's the man. And so in his greatness, he then forms a covenant with these people that he just freed, his new people, Israel. And so that's at Mount Sinai in the chapter right before our text. And a lot of us probably know what happens there. He forms a covenant of which the Ten Commandments are a part of. And at the core of this covenant is the first two commandments, to give utter loyalty and devotion and worship alone to God. But let's just mention the elephant in the room, so to speak. In verse 5, it says that God is a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate him. A lot of people read that and walk away with the impression that God's pretty arrogant, egotistical, and narcissistic. I think it's, we as Christians, there's no fear. I mean, there are tough parts of the Bible, and we don't have to hide behind anything. And so I could go into more detail about this text and its cultural setting with you one-on-one or through an email. There's plenty of scholars and commentators that have pretty good takes on this that put it in its proper context, and it's far less offensive than what it sounds like to our modern ears. But I want you just to get this big overall take of the feeling that this can kind of leave you in when you hear things like that. There's a well-known British literary author, C.S. Lewis. And if you know C.S. Lewis, he was the guy who authored the Chronicles of Narnia. So if you've read those books or seen those movies, this is actually a question that Lewis struggled with before he became a Christian. He was a committed atheist, actually. And so he left us journals and diaries and stories and books of all the questions and the things that he struggled with. And this was one of them. And I think he shed some pretty good insight on this. We'll have it up here on the screens. He says this: the most obvious fact about praise, whether of God or anything, strangely escaped me. I thought of it in terms of compliment, approval, or the giving of honor. I had never noticed that all enjoyment spontaneously overflows into praise. The world rings with praise, lovers praising their mistresses, readers their favorite poet, walkers praising the countryside, players praising their favorite game. I think we delight to praise what we enjoy because the praise not merely expresses but completes the enjoyment. It is its appointed consummation. It is not out of compliment that lovers keep on telling one another how beautiful they are. The delight is incomplete until it is expressed. So rather than maybe a list of just moral rules to follow, a way to get to heaven, what if the Ten Commandments are actually getting at something else? Israel has already been freed. They've already been released from bondage to Egypt. And now God is mapping out the way, the guidelines, the principles for them to continue in that freedom. If you noticed, I stopped reading after the second commandment. There are a lot of Jewish scholars who would really call the Ten Commandments nine commandments, and that's because the first two commandments, they would lump into one. They're kind of the same coin with two different sides, so to speak. They're both really similar. Not only are they similar, but they're the utter foundation, the core of Israel's life. If you got the first commandment or the first two commandments, depending on how you look at it, if you got those right, well, you'd probably get the rest right. If you got one of those wrong, you would probably get the rest wrong. And so this idea of worshiping God alone and to give him complete devotion and loyalty was at the core of Israel's life. But if you know Israel, you know the story of the Old Testament, this is actually the very thing that they struggled with. There's just countless stories of them going after other gods. So God's not an idiot. He knows this. So he gives them the Ten Commandments. And so presumably Israel is going off to the land of Canaan, the promised land, but there would be a really big pull and lure and temptation to go after other gods. Wasn't just kind of some flirtation with the belief that there are multiple gods, although that was there too. It was actually far more practical than that. If I'm an Israelite and maybe my neighbor is a Canaanite because I'm living in their land, well, agriculture is everything. Crops are everything in that world. And what if his crops and his fruits are just booming that year? So I'd ask him, hey, man, like, how you doing so well? Like, give me the magic formula too. Oh, yeah, okay, well, you know what? I actually just follow the magical rituals of the gods I serve, and then they promise to bless me with food. And so I sacrifice my child, I do these other things, and this is why my crops and my fruit and everything else is just booming. That was the temptation and the lure that Israel had to go after other gods. It wasn't kind of just some intellectual thing. But what if God is actually looking out for their good, that he's jealous for them? Jealousy in our context, in our world, someone tells me someone's jealous, I automatically think negative about them. They're insecure, they're not comfortable in their own skin, they're not content with what they have, they want something else. It's not a good thing. What about jealousy out of a faithful, loving husband, God, who loves his beloved wife, Israel, and is jealous for her well-being? He wants the best for her. I think this is what's going on here. So Israel's going off to the promised land, enticed to go after other gods, and God wants the best for their well-being. What will bring order, what will bring life, what will bring purpose, and ultimately, this running stream, what will bring freedom. So Lewis, I think we delight to praise what we enjoy because the praise not merely expresses but completes the enjoyment. The desire is incomplete until it is expressed. So going along with Lewis then, God, by commanding Israel to worship him and him alone, was instead giving them the opportunity to complete their desires and enjoyment instead of being shortchanged by going after all the other false gods around them. Now here in sunny Southern California, 2015, I don't think we probably feel too tempted to go after physical idols or fertility gods of other nations. At least I don't. But isn't there still the very real pull and lure to go after other gods, just like Israel? Every single human being worships someone or something. We usually think of worship as a religious word. I want to say it's actually a human word. Because the human heart is like a mini idol factory. You can't help but devote and commit and to be loyal to someone or something, no matter what it is. It's impossible to not. That's a human being. That's how we're wired. Worship just means to give worth to someone, to something. We all do that. We all have what Tim Keller, who's a pastor in New York City, calls counterfeit gods. And so the litmus test to figure out what your counterfeit gods are to simply ask yourself, what do you spend the most time thinking of, dreaming of, and putting excessive energy over in place of God? What occupies your imagination and your priorities to an exuberant degree? I'm not talking about, you know, food or water or transportation. We all need those things. Although maybe, I guess, suppose you could still worship those things. But our counterfeit gods often start with really good and healthy and normal things. And that's why we start with them, because they are good. We think that whatever it is may offer us freedom, that we'll be in control, that we'll be fulfilled. So of course we start with good and healthy things. But it's when we make these healthy things, when we elevate them and make them ultimate realities, and we put them in the place of God and commit utter loyalty and devotion to them, that these objects begin then to consume us and they fail to deliver what we thought they would deliver. And they actually end up enslaving you. So I remember for the longest time, my counterfeit God, and still to some degree is, I'm not perfect, love and relationships. Now, some of you women out there are probably like, man, I wish my husband really wanted love or relationships. But what I mean by that is, I've always thought that if I found Miss Perfect, Miss Right, that I would be okay, that I'd be in complete bliss, the world would be great, it'd be a Disney fairy tale, and I would be good to go, I wouldn't have any worries, I don't know, Lion King, Hakuna Matata, no worries. It's all good. And so the problem, though, is that I would then come to expect some girl to fulfill all of my longings, all of my innate longings for intimacy, for happiness, and all these other mushy-gushy human feelings that we all have. Breaking news, no human being can actually fulfill all of those things. They're not God. And so even my girlfriend Rachel, who's as darling and beautiful and perfect as they come, isn't God. Although I know I bought it when she spoke at Advent by candlelight about a month ago, I think I had like 10 to 15 women coming up to me afterwards. Mark, when are you gonna put a ring on that thing? I think you guys maybe thought she was God. But the thing with Rachel, though, if I elevate Rachel to the status of a God, we're in deep trouble, both her and me, because she's just as broken and human and fragile as I am, and she will fail me at times, and I will fail her. And so if I put these huge expectations on her and this pressure on her that she feels like she has to please all my desires and give me all these things, well, that's just not gonna happen. And so it's gonna make her life worse and I'll be disappointed as a result. So we could compile a whole list of all these other modern day gods in our culture, especially during, you know, New Year's resolutions. We have all these things, body and self-image, money, larger pension plans, status and power. And so take, for example, a common New Year's resolution. I was actually somewhat surprised by this one. I researched the top 10 New Year's resolutions. One of them was to get a better job or get a better education. Good thing. Let's be ambitious people. I'm all for that. We should always look for ways to advance ourselves. But doesn't it become so easy for us to focus on this so much that this idea of getting better in our field or expertise consumes you? I was in LA before this. I did ministry there, and I saw this with people in the entertainment industry. The thing, though, is if that's you, you'll constantly be full of envy and resentment towards those who are better than you, because there'll always be someone better than you. Or you use your job or your education to define your life, your very existence. And then you discover that you hurt people in the process. You only associate with the attractive, the powerful, the well-connected. And this process of just trying to get better, it just eventually wears on you. Because guess what? When you finally land that dream job, that dream position, guess what you have to worry about next? Someone else taking it. Someone else who wants to be just like you. In fact, they'd be more equipped than you. So now you have to worry about staying there. And then maybe a couple months later, you're not even satisfied with it. You want something bigger and better. So this is the cycle, the fabric of how counterfeit gods work. The psychology behind it, if you will. And we can do the same thing with exercise and eating healthier at this time of the year. And I'd be the first to say, I need to do more. I've actually already started eating healthier. Saturated fat, carbohydrates, sugars, out the window. But if you're not careful with that, if you don't do it in balance and moderation, you'll find yourself in the same thing. We think these things will offer us freedom, but if we're not careful, they can do the opposite and actually spiral your life out of control. Nothing was meant to occupy the throne of your heart. And that's actually a good thing, because ultimately, they can't. They're not God. So you want to know what will make this life stress-free for you, will ultimately improve the health of your life forever? It's not a new self-help book. It's worshiping the only real and ultimate God revealed in Jesus, who gives us a deeper and more true exodus, an exodus that's going to release you from all your phony gods and provides you with a relationship that will give you true, real, fulfilling worship. The same God who at Mount Sinai thousands of years ago issued these two commandments is here today. And if you're tired, you're weary, you're frustrated, you're disappointed, you've had enough, just says, hey, come to me. I'll give you rest. You're thirsty? I'll give you something to drink. He's the only one who can truly fulfill your desire to worship. The only God, as C.S. Lewis hinted at, who can actually complete your desires. So we can start this new year doing all the New Year's resolutions. I'm totally not bashing on New Year's resolutions. I think they're great. I've already set some goals for myself. So some of us will have success. Most of us probably won't meet them. That's okay. The one thing I know from my personal story, from the stories of families and friends, is this. God has made you to worship him. And you will be restless until you rest in him. So we start off with Kanye West, a little Hollywood pop culture figure for you. Figure why not end with another one? Brad Pitt. Now, the interesting thing about Brad Pitt isn't that he's good looking. The interesting thing about Brad Pitt is that he actually grew up in an evangelical Christian home. I didn't know that until I found this out. And interestingly enough, the main reason why Brad Pitt left the Christian faith was actually over this very notion that he thought God was arrogant, egotistical, and narcissistic. He writes this, I didn't understand this idea of a God who says, you have to acknowledge me, you have to say that I'm the best, and then I'll give you eternal happiness. If you won't, then you don't get it. It seemed to be about ego, and I can't see God operating from ego, so it made no sense to me. I think he's right. Thank you, Mr. Pitt. He's onto something. God's operating from ego. That just doesn't seem right. We know in our bones, we don't like arrogant, narcissistic, egotistical people. Fortunately, though, I think the part that good old Mr. Pitt misses is that God isn't operating out of ego. in commanding us to worship him, he's operating out of love for our good. So we instinctively find ourselves longing to praise and devote someone or something. We naturally gravitate towards relationships, material possessions, body image, whatever, to fill this God-sized hole. Great and excellent things in and of themselves, but we turn these good things into ultimate realities to counterfeit God's. So this morning, maybe it'd just be helpful to kind of take a personal inventory of yourself. What are the gods that are robbing you of finding ultimate joy, to meet your deepest desires? I think one way to figure that out is this question. What one thing, if removed from your life, would change your everyday? I'm not talking about water or food or transportation, but what one thing, if removed from your life, would change your everyday? Because these gods can't be expelled. That's not enough for the human heart. Months, years later, we'll go back to them, we'll find a new one, fail another New Year's resolution. They need to be replaced. Replaced by the only one and true ultimate God, revealed in Jesus, so that our feelings for lasting joy, fulfillment, security, identity, and unconditional love can be met and satisfied and fulfilled. That's why God commanded, "You shall have no other gods before me. You should not make for yourself an idol, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." It's the same God who, as Tim Keller, pastor in New York City, said, I love this quote. He said this, "God's the only Lord who, if you find him, can truly fulfill you. And if you fail him, can truly forgive you." So I'm going to invite the music team back up. They're going to lead us in a couple songs. This is usually our time of response. We usually have multiple response stations available. This morning, we're just going to take communion as a family. That's going to be our main response. So in a couple of minutes, Juno and I are going to talk about the significance of communion and what that means. But if you're new with us, if you're not a follower of Jesus, maybe this just seems strange to you. That's okay. The early church were accused of being cannibalists because there were stories being told that they're eating someone's body and blood. So we just ask, hey, you don't have to partake. We're not going to judge you. We're not going to look at you strangely. So just use this time to reflect, to ask yourself, what are your gods, and are they really fulfilling you?